The following is an interview with Mr. Raymond Dawson at his office in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, on February 4th, 1991. Let's start just by talking about the background of the case, and maybe if you can recall the first time that it began to occupy your time and your attention. It must have been pretty much from the beginning of your, when you came as vice president here? Or?
Yeah, the ruling of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit on this, on the Adams case, came, I believe, in the spring of 1972. Just as we were getting restructured, reorganized. So when I came out here in June and July of 72, that was one of the issues. Now, the university had had some correspondence with the Office for Civil Rights that I remembered over the preceding two or three years off and on, but it obviously, the whole issue took a new focus and a new directive in 72 when the D.C. court made that ruling. During the next, I would say, year and a half, I was not very closely involved in that. It was handled mostly by the Vice President for Planning, who was then Cameron West. The Office for Civil Rights was working, trying to develop guidelines, so things were not moving with blinding speed, as I recall. But we were put on notice that we'd have to develop a plan, and we discussed it at staff meetings from time to time, very frequently, in fact. And Dr. West was doing most of the drafting. He left to accept an appointment in Illinois. I guess that must have been sometime along in 1973. And John Sanders became vice president for planning. And he picked up a major responsibility for the development of a plan. I can't recall if it was before or after Cameron West left and John Sanders came that HEW raised questions and objections about the first plan that we put forward. And so John Sanders, working with Dick Robinson and a subcommittee of the, or a special committee, I guess it was, of the Board of Governors, went to work on doing the work for the preparation of another plan. That was the so-called revised state plan that was finally approved by HEW in June 1974. If you will note, this was running parallel in time to the great debate over medical education. And I found a large part of my time absorbed in that. And in some other legislative and other matters. But during 1974, I remember getting much more closely involved, and I recall that at some point during that year, I went with President Friday and Mr. Sanders and Dick Robinson, maybe one or two others, to one meeting in Washington with the director of the Office for Civil Rights, who was then Peter Holmes, and his staff to talk about our plan and to get their comments as to how we could get it in shape for them to approve it. And then they did approve it. It was finally approved in June of 74. And by that time, the issue was beginning to get sort of right in the center of everything, working out some kind of accommodation with HEW. It subsided a little when they accepted the plan in June of 74, Though then we had to get some machinery put in place to start making annual reports and to get regular reporting cycles and processes designed. Let me stop there. You're getting ready to ask me a question.
I was just going to ask you about Peter Holmes, director of our OCR. I was wondering if you could just give me a little bit more detail about what sort of person he was to work with, how he negotiated, how...
Holmes was a very quiet and overall seemed to be a very reasonable person. I remember it at that meeting up there, he was raising some questions about our plans, and he and President Friday had a very amicable exchange about, it seemed to me Mr. Holmes accepted pretty clearly that we wanted to work to the same purpose they wanted to work to. We wanted to promote the racial integration of our campuses. We didn't want to be in a position where there was any discrimination against blacks in the university system. And see, their initial guidelines that we were working under pretty much at that time, I guess they were issued in November of 1973, put a very heavy emphasis upon increasing the enrollment of white students at the historically black camps. So there was a very heavy emphasis on that. So my recollection was that in the brief period of time we worked with Peter Holmes, that we generally found him a person with whom we felt we could work. Mm-hmm. He left, however, not long after our plan was accepted. I don't recall the exact time, but I don't recall all the chronology of this bill. Some of it you can get out of AKP. But the next big step was again, I'm not sure of the chronology. The next big steps were these. There came to be a debate on the vet strip. Mm-hmm. Then there came to be a lot of pressure on the Office for Civil Rights in HEW to reject not only our plan, but everybody's plan. This seemed to have been occasioned by a motion filed by the Legal Defense Fund, the LDF, in the same U.S. District Court in Washington. See, the case was up there. Mm-hmm. And it's important to remember, through all the discussion, that we were not parties to the lawsuit. This was a lawsuit brought by Adams et al., supported by the LDF, against the United States government for not enforcing Title VI of the Civil Rights Act in 10 southern states which had historically had de jure segregation in public as well as elementary and secondary, in higher as well as in elementary and secondary education. So the suit was against the federal government itself to force them to enforce the law. And the LDF attempting to tell them exactly how it ought to be enforced. And not all the southern states were named. It was a curious kind of mixture. Maryland was named, Virginia was named, North Carolina was named, not South Carolina. They were not named. Georgia was named, Florida, Alabama was not. Mississippi and Louisiana were not. Texas was not. Arkansas was. Oklahoma was. I believe West Virginia was in the initial thing.
Was there any logic to that?
The logic was in the case of Louisiana and Mississippi, those two states simply refused to submit plans. As I recall, they said, in effect, we're not in violation of the law. If you think we are, sue us. And so the federal government initiated separate legal action against them. Mississippi State's this case is still going through the courts. And the Louisiana case, I guess, was settled with a consent decree after hours, and I think it's back in the courts. So those two cases are still going on. I was reading something today about the Mississippi case. The Justice Department has filed another motion in the Mississippi case this past week. South Carolina and Alabama were just out on political grounds. I mean, this was the early days of the Nixon administration, and I don't think there's any question that George Wallace and Strom Thurmond had some muscle to pull on the Republican Party, and they were simply not met. And Texas, I think, the same explanation. Tennessee was under separate litigation, so that was straightforward. So anyway, we were among the named states.
Just to get this straight, the suit went against the government, went against the federal government. The federal government then named the states. They're requesting plans.
That's right. The suit named the states. A very careful selection. Interesting selection of states.
The selection occurred on the part of the HEW, then?
Well, on the part of the LDL.
Yes, in consultation with the LDL.
Manipulate and so forth.
Yeah.
The essence of a lawsuit is, of course, that there really be a case in controversy. And as time went on, it was not at all clear that it was really a controversy between the LDL as the plaintiffs and HEW as the defendant. And this began to show during 75, I think it was, when the LDF went into court and filed this motion to order the court to overrule HEW and declare all these plans invalid. At about that juncture, a man named Martin Gerry, G-E-R-R-Y, became the director of the Office for Civil Rights. We read the LDF motion in the Adams case, trying to get all these suits declared, these plans declared unacceptable. The Board of Governors even debated for a time whether we should intervene in the suit, because it was a very sweeping brief that the LDF filed. It made no distinctions whatsoever between public and elementary and secondary education. Higher education and elementary and secondary seemed oblivious to all that, called for some highly punitive measures and against the states, and for the first time clearly surfaced the proposition that in the case of public higher education, where you do not have mandatory attendance and you do not have assignment of schools, pupil assignment plans, that you do have as a mechanical device to move students around the assignment of programs. And that figured pretty prominently in that first LDF brief in 75, saying that, you know, if you move programs, you compel students to move with them, and that's the way you mix up the institutions. It quoted at one point the Swan decision, the Charlotte Mecklenburg case, which said that what our goal has to be is no black schools and no white schools, but just schools. Now, the people who were really alarmed by that brief was an organization called NAFEO, N-A-F-E-O. That's the acronym. National Association for Equal Opportunity in Higher Education. Now, NAFEO is the Association of Black Colleges. That's their group, public, private, about 112 of them. They saw this as a threat to the historical identity of the black college. They filed a counter motion in the court against this, and said that since they had been themselves, that is the institutions, had been themselves the victim of discrimination and segregation, that they should not be singled out as a part of the remedy. And so their position was that, that they were in full compliance with the law, and that insofar as the makeup of their student bodies were concerned, they had always been open to all. The fact that they were of a clearly racial identifiability was because of the law of the oppressors. And so the dire consequences ought to fall on the oppressors, and that what should be done as a remedy was to build up and strengthen the black institutions. Now, as I say, our board talked about should we intervene in the Adams case, and wisely said no, said we do not want to put ourselves under the jurisdiction of a federal court up in Washington, D.C., that'd be a mistake. And in the meantime, as I say, came the vet school issue. And the question came up, why not put the vet school at A&T? And the School of Veterinary Medicine had been authorized just before restructuring. Old Board of Trustees and University under Governor Scott had gone on record, we're going to develop a veterinary school and establish the Department of Veterinary Science at NC State. And then we did a study about the vet school, and the decision was to locate it at State. And then came the proposal, well, it's located at North Carolina A&T. So along in this would have been late 74, I guess, or maybe early 75, at a meeting of the Board of Governors, the director of the Atlanta Regional Office of the Office for Civil Rights, a Mr. William Thomas, just appeared at the board meeting and asked to be heard on the issue of the location of the veterans. Let him be heard. It was an interesting kind of thing because in the meantime, we were in the process of having to develop the medical school of East Carolina. And I remember one member of the Board of Governors asked him, said, well, you've expressed all this interest in the location of the vet school. What about the location of the medical school? Are you interested in asking us to consider whether the new medical school should be a historically black campus? He said, no, I'm not interested in that. He said, I consider that a done deal, or words to that effect. And I'm not going to get involved in that.
How did Thomas get into this, do you think? Where is he?
Well, it's clear that the chancellor or the folks over at A&T were prompted to put in a petition for the vet school.
Prompted by?
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there were some very active organizations in those days. Now, I would remind you that on the Board of Governors was one of the principal officers of the LDL, Julius Chambers. So Julius was on the Board of Governors.
He's still on the Board.
Stayed on the board until 1977. Then there was an organization called Coalition of Alumni and Friends. Does that ring a bell?
Black Alumni Group.
Black Alumni Group. They were very active. And so there were a lot of people participating in this, and they all had direct pipelines into LDF, which in turn had direct pipelines into OCR. Mm-hmm. And
they're feeding each other information.
And they weren't going to get involved in the medical school fight because they knew they'd get the hell beat out of them. Mm-hmm. And they weren't about to lie down in front of a locomotive because, the Democratic Party, as the Board of Governors and everybody else found out, you couldn't deal with that luxury. It was, they left the station long ago. But the vet school, they decided to see if they could derail that. The hook that they finally found in the course of that discussion is Thomas pointed out that the Board of Governors in this June 1974 plan had committed itself to do a racial impact study in connection with the location of any new program. We had not done one since our frame of reference had been the old trustee resolution, which initially looked toward the establishment of the vet school. And so there was general knowledge, all right, we ought to do a racial impact study. So the board did not postpone any action and we did a racial impact study. That meeting must have been more like September or night of 74 or something of that nature. We came back in another month or two with a racial impact study, which I guess John Sanders did. And we concluded we would look at the program at NC State.
As I understand this vet school, the original idea of the vet school was unusual in university decision making and governance in the sense that it came from outside groups rather than being generated from within.
I'm not sure that been so unusual itself, but not entirely. See, its biggest proponent was the governor, who was chairman of the Board of Trustees, under the old structure. And the old Board of Higher Education had done a study. It had a lot of things going for it. Would probably, you might talk to someone like President Friday or Felix Joyner and some of them who were here in the general administration when I was up in Southville at that time, had no involvement with the vet school. They have a better picture on this than I. But my reading of it, Bill, would be that the whole vet school thing would have been resolved sooner than it had been if it hadn't been restructuring fight. Because clearly Governor Scott had a clear interest in it. He had a lot of support from the NC State people. There was a big movement behind it. I think the restructuring debate just sort of put it on hold. And then as soon as that was done, it was picked up again. And as I say, that was kind of the frame of reference in which everyone was acting. But we acknowledged that we had to do this racial impact statement and did one. And came down with the decision, the recommendation that it be located in NC State.
Do you think
that would have been late 74, early 75? Because then we filed a supplemental budget request for the vet school, I remember, for the 75 session of the General Assembly. And just about that time, so you had the vet school controversy and a lot of stirring on going about our plan, and then came that LDF brief. And in reaction to NAFIO to that, and then H.E. Davis sort of fell on us. We did not file by the due date of December 31 or 1974, or whenever it was, our first semi-annual report on our desegregation plan. We were still trying to design the reporting system. I would just observe in passing, that the first year for which we collected data on enrollments by race on all 16 public senior institutions in North Carolina was 1972. Now, we had some episodic data going back in the 60s, but in the late 1960s or very early in 1970, when I was Dean of Arts and Sciences at Chapel Hill, in which capacity I also served as chairman of the Chancellor's Advisory Committee on Admissions. So Dean of Arts and Sciences did a lot of admissions work. We were then ordered by HEW at some point during my four-year tenure up there as dean that we could not ask a person's race on their application for an Reformation. See, we went through that period when you couldn't acknowledge race. And then they turned right around and said, well, you got to tell us how many black people applied, and so forth and so on. So there was a lot of confusion, but my point was we had a real job getting some kind of reporting system in place. And remember, we were dealing with a system where we had no record of relationships and things with the five historically black campuses or with all the old regional universities. We were still going through a period of sort of consolidation of the new structure. And so we were late, not surprisingly. And it didn't amount to a hill of beans anyway, but they picked up on that and wrote up just early in the spring, or late in the spring, I guess it was, 1975, just wrote a blistering letter to President Friday about all the things we were doing wrong or not doing, citing mostly the vet school, the fact that we were late filing our report. They were meanwhile putting a lot of pressure to bear on Office for Civil Rights to repudiate these plans if had administratively accepted. And finally, HEW just folded, as a matter of fact. Now that's my word, and that's the way I would characterize it, but we knew they were working on it. And you look up the dates in that other material, but at some point HEW just informed us our plan was no longer accepted and informed all the other states the same thing, that their plans were no longer accepted. Didn't say why, didn't say, you know, this is the reason. It just said they're no good, they're not working. So your plan's no longer acceptable. I was thinking, in the meantime, there was one other big debate that we had on this issue. It was in that 1974 plan. We agreed to do a study of the five historically black institutions, particularly looking at their at comparative levels of financial support by the state. And any other thing that seemed to be relevant. And we got that, we finished that comparative study on in 1975, I guess, and filed that quickly. And that was a focus of a great deal of debate and discussion in the Well, all of which is to say that obviously by the latter part of 74 on into 75, this was becoming kind of a overriding issue with virtually everything that we were doing. And we found it very difficult to communicate with the Office of Civil Rights, OCR, on this. This was a very great and real concern for President Friday. You know, as to how we could reach some kind of understanding and accommodation on this. We were not looking for a fight. And when we tried to keep up this theme that what HEW says it wants is what we want. And we hope that we can find some way to accomplish our common purpose that we can both come to accept. That is, as to the way we go about it. But that was getting harder and harder to communicate with them during 75, and then finally they just repudiated the claims. And so we, nothing to do but to wait and see what kind of ruling we got from them. By then we were hot into the elections of 1976, and Mr. Carter won, and appointed Joe Califano as his Secretary of Education, Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Secretary of HEW. And a new director of the Office for Civil Rights took over, David Taylor. And we sort of, you know, stood by and waited to see what was going to happen. President Friday knew Joe Califano, had known him for a long time. They worked together during the Johnson years when President Friday was on the White House Fellows Commission. And in fact, I remembered in 1970, when I was dean, President Friday did us the favor of getting Joe Califano to come down here and give a speech over in Hill Hall, if I remember one night. Califano was at that time one of the key people working with that commission designed to reform the Democratic Party. And that was the subject of his lecture that night. And we had to find some ashtrays to put up on the podium at Hill Hall because Joe was quite a smoker in those days. And, you know, we hoped that we would have some reasonable people with whom we could establish a sound working relationship to do what needed to be done. We now know and found out shortly after, during the course of our lawsuit, that Califano appointed a commission, and they went to work to rewrite the guidelines that had been issued back in November of 73, and made a conscious decision not to consult with any of the universities or states about those. They were developed in secret. But along in the, I guess the late winter or early spring of 1977, President Friday was contacted and said that Mr. Califano's special assistant, no, his counsel, the counsel for HEW's general counsel, Mr. Peter Labasi, Libassi, and his aide, who was David Brennan, wanted to visit with us. Labasi was a very prominent attorney. David Brenneman was, I guess Dave was an economist. He'd been on the staff out at the Brookings Institution in Washington. He later became president of, a private college in Michigan. And I think he's still a college president. But they were Mr. Califano's emissaries who were going to come and talk to us about, we assumed what we were going to be called on to do. Because we knew we were sitting here with a rejected plan, and we knew that H&W was under a court order. It had to do something. And so, that was the first word that we had, that they would be coming to visit us. Now, remember, they arrived on a Sunday, and so we had a long session in that conference room right around the corner. The president invited the chairman of the Board of Governors, who was Mr. William A. Johnson, Judge Johnson from Wilmington. He was present to me. I was there. Felix Joyner was there, Dick Robinson was there, Cleon Thompson was there. That's probably pretty much the group, and then Labasi and Brennan. Labasi had a tablet on his lap, and he would speak from that tablet, and that clearly was a draft. Working draft of what came to be known as the criteria, which were the new guidelines. But they were going to issue them as they were called criteria. I didn't think I'd ever forget the full name.
Let's see. Stuff here, so yeah, here's the Empire State Plan. Do you want to go through our state plans and consent decree at some juncture? And then all these dates, you really ought to go through these. Let's see. Yeah, the full title is Criteria Specifying the Ingredients of Acceptable Plans to Desegregate State Systems of Public Higher Education. And that's what he was working off of. He raised, you know, a lot of good questions. It was a good discussion, but it was clear that the focus now was on increasing Black participation and increasing Black presence at the historically white campuses. There's very little said about white presence at the historically Black campuses. That was just not on their minds. But they made it clear that there were going to be some standards set for us to meet in these other two areas. And looked like it sounded as though they're going to be very severe standards and very difficult to meet. they stayed over, I believe we met a while that the following morning, Monday morning, and then they left. And we heard nothing more. We now know, and the criteria came to reflect this, that the federal government had something of a dilemma on its hands. The LDF brief back in early 1975 quoted with approval the dictum in Swan versus Mecklenburg: no Black schools, no white schools, just schools. That's not what the Black institutions want. And you began to see after that, and it became clear in those discussions with Lavasi and Brenneman, and then it became clear to us in the criteria, that there were really sort of two flags here that one could march under, and they were not necessarily in competition with one another in all senses, but they also were in a way fundamentally competitive. One was integration, the other was preservation of Black colleges. Because, you see, we were declared to be in violation of the Civil Rights Act. I guess the 14th Amendment was thrown into the good measure. Because we were operating a racially dual system of public higher education. And that racial duality was always documented by the fact that we had five institutions whose student bodies were overwhelmingly Black, and 11 institutions whose student bodies were overwhelmingly white. Now, was the idea to get a racial balance reflecting the whole population on all 16, or what? So these goals, you know, finally can become right on. And we found the federal government had two flags that it would march under from time to time as circumstances warranted. One of them was integrate. The other was develop the Black institutions. We had no issue with them in a real sense over the development of the Black institutions. But our problem was that we were and I told we were in violation of the law, and we never could get any kind of guide or standard out of them as well, what would be the characteristics of a unitary system? If ours is racially dual, tell us what it is we have to be not to be racially dual. And that's the question we could never get the answer for, except we were simply told, well, do what we tell you to do, and we'll let you know. Now, this was I cannot overemphasize, Bill, this was 1976-77, but I cannot overemphasize to you how difficult our predicament was. Everyone involved in this on the university side had been a proponent of the civil rights movement. We had all been proponents of the integration of the university. And some of us had had an active role, for example, in working to increase black enrollment at Chapel Hill and elsewhere. Just the symbolism of being in conflict with or at odds with the civil rights establishment was painful. Because while there were still some quarters who would give you high marks for just being in opposition to the Office of Civil Rights, those were not generally the quarters that we looked to as the people with whom we like to compare ourselves, starting with our faculties. Because faculty members, you know, assumed that the civil rights establishment was right. And they were, and again, this was not long after the height of the movement in the 60s. So what was wrong with us? What is it we're doing wrong? And this was very difficult for the president. Because we knew what it finally came down to is that we were being asked to do things which were unreasonable and detrimental to the university and destructive, we believe, to the purposes that we thought we should be working toward. But we were being told that by people and offices and organizations who were identified automatically as the champions of civil rights. And so it was a hard thing to think through is, do we want to take on the civil rights establishment? Isn't there some way to live with them at peace? How do we get our fix where we're their enemy? Now, Labasi was very candid about this in a conversation with President Frye. He told him that he should understand that among the powers up in Washington, who were, I'm sure he was referring to the LDF and the folks running the Office of Civil Rights, that they had singled out the University of North Carolina. Their feeling was if they could break the University of North Carolina, they could get anyone. Now, that's what we were told. And everything that happened from 1976 onward tended to bring out that we were being set aside as a special case.
That specifically came from Labasi?
Labasi, and Labasi acknowledged it.
He acknowledged it.
To Frye. Yeah. He acknowledged that we were being singled out. Now, on the one hand, there was good reason to single us out, because more than any state, North Carolina had a racially dual system. We had five historically black public campuses. Virginia had two, South Carolina had one, Georgia had three, Florida had one. You get my point. I mean, this state came closer than anyone in constructing really a dual system. So that was kind of logical in a way. But then the other thing they knew was that here was the most prestigious state university in the South. Possible exception of Texas, but Texas wasn't even a party to the suit. And so Chapel Hill, you know, had a unique place. At that time, there was no member of the AAU except Chapel Hill, between Charlottesville and Austin. And then there was the fact that it was Chapel Hill. So that's where we were, and that was kind of the horns of the dilemma upon which we find ourselves. The criteria were finally presented to us in July. And in fact, they were delivered to President Friday by special delivery or Federal Express or something like that. But they were delivered to his home on July the 4th, 1977. Califano had them sent down to him. Califano professed to be very proud of them, something we can all live with and find our way through. President Friday got them, called me. I remember he and Felix and I met out here, Cleon Thompson. Felix and I went down to the copy machine, made a copy for all of us, and we went off to study them, and we began meeting on them the next day. And a number of things in them promptly caught our eyes. There were some standards in there. And John Sanders was involved in all this too. So we had our marching orders in one sense in these criteria. Now, could we pick up there at another time?
Sure.
I apologize.